what I'd like to move on to is first of all to suggest that these goals and values, that we have for our children, no matter which list they come off of, the one in manuscript or the one in cursive, are really our blueprint, our blueprint for our family. They're where we would like to go with our family, what we would like to accomplish with our family. And as our children grow older, they just seem to grow older faster and faster, and it's almost like you're running out of time to make a difference in their lives. But the first thing I'd like to talk about, what I want to do is present kind of a list of things, and then hope that you will share some of your experiences as they relate to these things, but factors that influence our family blueprint. Think about how it is that we came up with this particular set of goals and objectives. What things made a difference? The first one that I'd like to throw out on the floor is that the level of maturity of the parents when they have their children will make some differences in what goals and objectives they have for their children. That could be simply a factor of age, or it could be the experiences from which you come, your own particular openness or awareness. And I guess I thought of two things out of my own experience that relate to this. But first of all, my first years of teaching were in an inner city junior high school, where I was privileged to have the 100 ninth graders who scored the lowest on the achievement test out of a school of about 1,300 children. And in my students, among my students, I had a number of children who were already parents, I had one girl who had two children already. And so to think of the kind of experiences and maturity that student was bringing to parenthood. And then I thought of us having our children when we were in our late 20s. And as opposed to some of our good friends who are having their children in their late 30s, and the difference that must make in your perspective and your patience and your all kind of things that have to do with parenthood. Another one that's closely related to that, and I think this one might be one that we would like to do some sharing about, is your own childhood experiences. One of the things that influences what we expect of our children is the way that we were brought up. There's very strong evidence to show that abusing parents were almost always abused themselves, that it perpetuates itself in families, and that's a very negative way to look at it. But perhaps we could think about your own experience with your parents. Have you used techniques or approaches that your parents used in raising your own children? Or have you directly and deliberately not done some things that your parents did in raising your own children? Can you think of examples that you might share? Yes.
I think I have found that I've done some of both.
Sure.
There were certain situations that developed that I wondered why my dad reacted the way he did, and I find now that I think it was probably because his dad reacted the same way, because I'm doing the same thing. But I'm trying to temper some of that and at least some of the worst parts. Mm-hmm.
Can you think of something specific?
Not really, although occasionally he would use a sense of humor in things. And I know with my oldest son, at times I would ask him if I needed to get to the seat of the problem, and he'd say, "Oh no, Dad, I know what that means."
It's a good example. Yes.
Well, I'm not real proud of this, but set cake allowances. My father would accumulate months before we get allowances, and then our perception would be different from what his perception is of his own. And I find that when payday comes and I've spent all the money and I don't really have enough to pay the allowances, then it drifts on, and then the kids have a different perspective than I do.
Mm-hmm.
I need to get to that problem.
Right.
Something to put aside.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I think that from my father and mother, I got two things. One was a spiritual background, which I purposely, knowingly kept.
Mm-hmm.
And the other was his desire to have me follow his steps on the farm, which I purposely rejected.
Mm-hmm.
And the second one I used as a motivation for my going on to school. I asked him for one more year each year. And I think I was in about the 11th or 12th grade. We lived in a farming community where you were supposed to leave school at the end of the 8th grade.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know whether it's the best motivation, but that was my motivation for going to school. And I knew I had to succeed if I was to be able to talk him out of that next year. By about the 12th grade, he realized what was happening. And credit to him, he then supported me. He could see that I wasn't
going to stay on the farm.
That's right. So that's sort of two things were, so I agree with the previous gentleman, choosing some of both.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Where you choose to follow and where you choose not to.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I grew up in a home where, until I went to school, I spoke German and French, and heard very little English in the home, so I had a really hard time learning to read one. And at that time, my parents decided that they wanted me to speak those languages, that I had to learn English. And consequently, I didn't learn to read till grade 4. So I really had a really hard start in school. And then my mother, being German, she was very, well, I wouldn't say aloof, but she just didn't display affection very easily. Whereas my father was French, and he was the huggy, touchy type.
Mm-hmm.
And I resented my mother when I got older as a teenager, and I really kind of fought her, you know. Went through a real, I don't know how you call it, what kids go, you know, teenagers go through.
I don't know what you call it either.
Yeah, you know, but I didn't have that with my dad. And it really took me a long time to work through and to realize how very much my mother loved me. You know, because I'd always felt that she was harsh and that she was non-loving. But now, as I got older, I realized how very much she loved me through all the time and the patience she had. And, like, I was always with her because we had very few kids in our neighborhood. So, you know, I was constantly at her elbow when she cooked, and she was a marvelous cook. And she never let me cook that much because, you know, her way was faster. And, you know, but I learned a lot just by watching.
Do you think that you model your father or your mother more in your relationship with your daughter?
I think I purposefully model my father more. Because I wish now, like my mother's dead now, and I really wish that I could have that she would have been more demonstrative.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But I've forgiven her for that. I've worked that through, and that was really that was really hard for me. To accept your relationship.
Fine. Yes.
I was just going to say I can relate to that as well. And not the touching, but the showing affection type. But I realized that this is the way she had been brought up, and that's how it came down through our family and our growing years.
Mm-hmm. And have you consciously tried not to model that?
I have consciously tried to be more affectionate with my children. But I wasn't that way until we had children. You know,
mm-hmm.
my husband comes from a very hugging type family.
Lots of kissing cousins.
Yeah. I was always the one that was kind of kind of would stand off, but it has changed since we've had children.
I saw it hanging up here.
One of the hardest things for me was I was brought up that anger was bad behavior, not a feeling at all. And so in learning to deal with a child's rage, it is real scary to me at times. And so I've had to try and separate the, like you say, to separate the behavior from the person and allow him to have his feelings of rage and put a damper on his expressions of it.
To help him channel it, instructing him.
Sure.
And so that's been like pioneering because I have no personal models for doing that, and every day feels like an experiment. And that's a choice, and being older yet has had a little background. I've gone through different stages of learning about my own anger that was put down all those years, or shoved down, or
not allowed to be shown.
I broke out in hives instead. But so you know, having my family, beginning at my age group.
And you're consciously trying to not do what your parents did, in a sense, in terms of allowing anger to be an acceptable thing. A closely related issue to this is that one of the things that affects this family blueprint is the relationship between the parents and the grandparents, and how that might affect the way, if you're the parent, how that affects the way that you treat your children, or what expectations you have, or what demands you make on your children. Just for an example, maybe to channel our thinking, it could be, this may be kind of an interesting example, it could be that the grandparents think that playing cards is not an acceptable thing to do, cards in general. Okay. And the parents think that playing, it doesn't bother the parents. So then your decision has to be whether or not you allow your children to play cards all the time, or is there a distinction between their playing cards everywhere except at grandmother's house? Can they not play cards when grandmother comes to your house? You know, how is it that you handle that running sort of conflict or disagreement between the parents and the grandparents?
Just an aside that occurs to me is that there can be a lesson in dealing with other people's beliefs in doing it that way. For example, in your example, is playing cards in their own house is fine, but the grandparents, since they frown on it, they should respect their beliefs and beliefs.
So it would be acceptable if they were at your...
It would be acceptable to me to handle it that way.
If they were at your home, the children could play. If they were at their grandparents' home, they could not play.
And that could be hard if you have parents that were fairly dominating, because you never quite grew out of being a child.
Exactly. Yes.
I had an interesting experience on this very subject. When I was about 13 or so, I went to spend a month with my uncle. And he got off the cards and taught us to play a few games of cards. And this was the first time I really had played. Then he told me the story behind it all, how no one was able to play cards in the family. And one time he went out and bought some cards, and my grandma took them away from him, and he asked for the money, you know, that she was taking away from him, and went and bought more cards. And after this cycle went on four or five times, she gave up and let him play cards. So it was almost like a mission that he was on, to teach us kids to play cards and to teach us an appreciation for it. And to this day, I have mixed feelings when someone asks me to play cards.
It's amazing how that has stayed with you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so. Yeah, it really is.
I know in my own family, when I was a youngster, we played cards a lot and took them to my grandparents' house and played cards. I spent a lot of time with my grandparents. And it wasn't until sometime within the past 2 or 3 years that my mother told me that until we as grandchildren took cards into my grandparents' home, there had never been cards in their home before. And they never said that we couldn't have them there, but my father was not allowed to have them when he was growing up. So I guess that's to my grandmother's credit, I guess. I don't think playing cards has hurt me a whole lot. Okay, let's move along and look at a couple of other things. Another factor that has influenced these things, probably especially those in the middle, would be the adult's level of knowledge and experiences. And I guess I'm thinking about the education one. If you are a college-educated person, it is much more likely that you will have that as an aspiration for your child, that if you value education, you will value it for your child. Or if you value getting rich, and it would be nice, that may be a goal that you would have with your child. Or just, you know, if you look at the more, I guess, admirable kinds of things that you listed first, your own awareness about humanness and what humanness means will affect what you say. Another one might be your personal dreams for your child, and that relates exactly to what you were talking about. What is it that you would like your child to become? You can especially think in terms of vocation. And some children get really messed up because they end up becoming whatever it is that their parents want them to become rather than what, I see some heads nodding, rather than what they would like to be. Are there comments that you wish to share or examples? Yes.
Well, my mother died when I was 18 and our family was stretched from 12 to 22 and my father was gone. And so we kind of bumbled along helping him out. But during that 12 to 22 range, my mother was very ill and dying for 4 years. So there was a period of time that we really didn't get any guidance as far as what she hoped or what any adult hoped us to become. And we've all been very lucky in finding a spot in our life. But we've all said to each other, we wish that we had been guided at that period of time and given some key points.
Okay. But not forced.
No. We were too much fun.
That wouldn't work. No danger. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, when you were mentioning the adult's level of knowledge and experience, it intrigues me sometimes the different places that we've lived. The friends that our children have developed, other kids have developed friendships with, and oftentimes the parsonages we've lived in are in lower income places. I don't know why that's next to the church. And more recently, the people who lived across the street with whom our children developed real strong friendship are marginal intellectually, on a marginal level, and socially, and are not very well socially accepted in the community. The family is not. And yet our children develop very strong friendships with them. And I over and over, I would talk to my husband about, isn't it interesting? Our children know that they'll go to college. I mean, they've been at different college campuses, and they just know they will. And for these other children, they'll be fortunate to get through high school. Okay. Mm-hmm. And yet, at this time in their life, you know, they don't know what that was all impacting on them. But as parents, it's kind of interesting
to watch
that and know how what different roads they will take, probably, mm-hmm. just because of parental experiences and knowledge and background that's so different.
Mm-hmm. Well,
and that goes without talking about it.
Right.
Our kids were the same.
Yeah.
It was just understood that they were going to go on, mm-hmm. and all preparations were in that direction without anyone ever saying. Now, my wife and I had agreed. Now, if one of them wants to be a plumber or a carpenter, that's fine with us.
They make a lot of money. Right.
But they all chose to go. So
without it ever being an issue.
Probably. That's right.
I guess he made the same point, but I would be a little reticent to say let's put that as an agenda to send every child to college and constantly be saying things like that. I work so hard to go to college. And blah, 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 you know.
Guilt trip.
I think that's the wrong reason to go to college. And there's a lot of good vocational schools, and there's a lot of life outside of the academic realm.
Certainly. Meredith?
I think that the role that the genes
play a big role. And, you know, it's a real gifted parent that can look at the child and not see themselves in it, even when perhaps they do have some physical characteristics or something. We have four children, two of whom are naturally born to us and two are adopted, but one is born to us. I have been a bookworm all my life. Loved reading as a kid. I'd go around the library, you know, in the school, and I'd read every single section except for fairy tales and fantasy. I couldn't stand them. I have a son who is the biggest bookworm in the world. The only thing he reads
is fairy tales and fantasy.
You know, so I think genes play a real big role, but sometimes in a different way than you think it does, you know. So it's something to kind of look at. And also, our two children that are more alike, we have sort of two sets. It's a biological and adopted that are alike, and a biological and adopted that are alike. So, you know, it's complicated.
It is. And my next point, as a matter of fact, and I'll just throw this out as we're talking, is the physical and emotional characteristics of the children. You know, that as you set these goals for your children, they have to be colored by what your children are like. What are their potentials? I saw some hands over here.
Yeah, I think it's very interesting that as much as they struggle to be independent and to want to be able to do their own thing, they will still come and check out with you kind of quietly, whether or not it's okay. When I know my daughter came and told me she was going to be a beautician, my first reaction was, oh, no. Not that I had anything against beauticians, but they work so hard for so little pay. And I really consciously tried to do that inwardly and not let her know. And I said, well, that would be good. You know, you get to fix hair and you get to do these other things. And then I always try to explore with them, well, what do you need to do to get there? And, you know, where do you have to go to get there? Right. And fortunately, she's given up being a beautician. She's now decided she's going to be an airline pilot because then she can afford to have a housekeeper.
You've been sharing a chalet with her. You know she needs one.
She's decided housekeeping's not cool, so she came and asked me if she was a pilot, if she'd make enough money to have a housekeeper. So then we discussed how she could get there, and she went to the library one day all by herself and looked at different colleges and decided that if she went in the service, then they would pay for her to be.
That's true.
And it's real interesting to watch them go through that process. Mm-hmm.
She's hanging it all together.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, aside from the verbal things we say to them, there are a lot of nonverbal things. Mm-hmm. Both she and I are active on campus, either teaching or tutoring or taking classes or doing whatever. Mm-hmm. And our kids see us in that environment. And see us enjoy that. Mm-hmm. And we're not saying to them, hey, we expect you to do the same thing, but we invite them to join us, and I think that they're seeing that we expect that. Mm-hmm.
That makes me think of one of Johnny's professors. As you're talking about how you model for your children, or they see these, get these nonverbal messages. But one of the professors at Vanderbilt has two children. My husband went to Vanderbilt. And the older of these children has basically rejected learning. I mean, he didn't finish high school. And then the daughter, who comes right behind him, is just an academic whiz and is where at Oberlin or? No, that's not.
She's finished
Oberlin. Oh, but anyway, but she was just a whiz in school. And it makes you wonder, both of them are very capable children. And it makes you wonder what it was, what kind of messages they were getting from their parents that made them turn out so dramatically different. Yes?
We adopted an 8-year-old boy, and I can't begin to tell you the way I feel about their genetic background. It's only now that I'm beginning to understand the heartache that we've had, and that I guess that we'll have to be willing to release him to God until he comes back and says, look, I need your help. You know, he's not gotten into drugs or alcohol or any of those things, but he just is verbally abusive to his dad and I. And we've had to, just before we came to hold him, we had to ask him to leave our home, which was really difficult. And I mean, he's a physically just a gorgeous kid, and we put him in a private school, a Lutheran high school last year,
that cost, you know, us a lot of money, hoping that he would sort of find there a social climate that he would feel good about himself. And that was great, but he failed grade 11 for the second time. And we don't have the $6,000 or $7,000 to put him back in that school again this next fall. And, you know, you can try all you want, loving and all this, and trying to give the, you know, hopefully get and create what you've got there. But if they dig in their heels at the age of 8 and fight you every inch of the way, eventually you just have to release them. Because they just will destroy you as individuals, at least you as individuals and in your marriage. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know within my heart that it's only because of our belief in God that we're together. Mm-hmm. As this kid has just, you know.
Thanks.
But that's one of the biggest risks you can ever take, is to adopt a child that,
oh,
you know,
yes,
that age, and where you just don't have any idea. I mean, you may have known where it's in his past, but...
But you don't know what... You don't know... You know, when you, and then we had a child, a little girl of our own. She's here with us. And, you know, when she comes and talks to us about things, you know, it's, you know, pretty well right on what she's talking about, because you were there in the creation of that concept. Mm-hmm. But with him, I mean... You know, he's come out with things that just, all I can do is listen and encourage him to talk about it, to try and get a picture of what he's talking about. And this is on and on and on, you know. Mm-hmm. But the thing that has really come to me in this Holden experience now is, through Dale Jambart, is the fact that we have to really go back, and for him it will be going back to forgive his mother for rejecting him and forgiving himself. Because he didn't do anything possibly to ask about. Mm-hmm.
Our children were 5 and 7 when they came in our home. The 5-year-old had been their natural brothers and had really been physically abused, and the 7-year-old hadn't. And yet the 7-year-old's the one who has the problems. Mm-hmm. I can relate to what you're saying.
You're one of the first people that has ever said that.
You all need to sit together.
We need to
lunch.
Sit and talk together.
But there's lots of hope. I mean, he's 20 years old now.
Well, I need that hope right now because he's only 18.
And my seven, you know, my that's 18 now is just, you know, he has blossomed from day one, mm-hmm. and the joy that there is in seeing a child like that. But how do you help? How do you reassure this child that is fits none of the molds that you want? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's hard. Yeah. You can relate to what you're saying. You speak right to me. Mm-hmm. I know.
Thanks, John.
I'd be kind of interested in hearing from others about whether they have any kind of family traditions that are structured. By that I mean something that is celebrated weekly or annually, and that the expectation is so strong that, I mean, everybody's going to be there to participate, and if these are carried on with a sense of shaping the child in a certain way,
okay.
If that's off your topic,
no, that's fine. I think it relates to
I've been real lucky. I told you about when we were children and how we splattered. Well, then we try to come together with our families a week before Christmas, before all the Christmas rush. We come from Central California and Oregon and wherever we are, and we meet for a weekend with our children and our spouses. And that's fun. Another thing I do is a Christian woman and husband, Cam and Steve, take my daughter for a week in the summer, and they've moved away, which is really nice. Then the third thing I do is we have family meetings once a week. And then the kids can present what their concerns are, what bothers them about their relationships with each other and with me, and we talk about that. And just this year, my 11-year-old, who was a real problem in the house as far as saying, I don't believe in God, and I constantly say to him, but he believes in you. I don't want to go to church. That's fine. You don't have to. He asked that we start reading the Bible together. And that lasted for 5 nights, but that was something that he brought to a family meeting.
Thank you.
Mary?
Well, we have kids from 5 to 17, and one thing that we found that's the best tradition that we can do is Holda. We come to Holda every summer, and even though I rarely see some of the children, it's a real tradition, and I think especially for the teenagers, because where we live, I'm amazed at them. You know, they bring home these wonderful, nice, clean-cut friends, very few of whom ever enter a church. And, you know, we don't live in Minneapolis anymore. Everybody goes to Lutheran church. And so that's a... It's become a real tradition in our family and a very... it's one of those almost nonverbal things. We don't... Not that we sit and talk about Vespers or even about Holden, but, you know, it's a... And it's a trek, too. It's a pilgrimage, you know, for us, especially coming a long way.
I guess I have a question, because we just have one little boy who's only 5 months old. But it seems to me that, you know, we're surrounded by a society that maybe gives lip service to family things, but doesn't give much support to that. And, you know, I too see Holden as a real help in, because the family is valued there. But what kinds of things do you do just on a day-to-day basis to develop those things and keep the family unit reasonably strong? You know, when, you know, TV and all of the outward things are kind of bombarding that.
One of my responses to that is to turn off the TV. We moved from Coos Bay. We've always had a TV, and we do watch TV. But I've been extremely hostile about it with my kids. For the television, not for them. We first lived in Coos Bay where there's one television channel, so it's not very appealing to watch TV. That was helpful. And then as they grew older, we live someplace now where the channels are equally appealing. And so it's not a big issue. They watch a tape of Sesame Street or something. I guess that gets harder as they get older. But I think if you do a lot of reading about both educational things and family things, you will find, for even reading skills, that the television uses can be extremely destructive. And the other thing is, I was talking to a pastor and his wife earlier this week that we're here, and I was asking, what does a pastor do at home? Do you have family devotionals and kind of stuff? And she said that even that is really hard, but they've tried real hard to set priority. It's like families do things like, as their kids grow older, they go to soccer and they do things, but it still tends to be kind of a splintering thing. And they've basically kind of taken an idea from the Mormon church as far as a family night. And I've taken that very seriously and put that as a priority over anything else, where the kids take part in planning it and stuff. And she said, that's been real helpful. As, at our age, with our kids' ages, we found that I think the number one thing to bring us together as a family is to read together with them at night. We're too ill to have the family meetings and things like that, but at this time, there's a time when there can be a forgiveness and a kind of a sitting down and holding, cuddling, good or bad, so that all the bad ones go away.
That's nice. Thank you.
I just have to jump in on that. It's shared experience that happened last night, talking about reading together as a family. The kids brought a few books along, the 10-and-a-half-year-old, but he hasn't read them. He doesn't be reading, even on the train when he was supposed to, running around. But he was really hostile towards us last night because we made him go to that session on anger.
I hope it was helpful.
He told me he didn't understand a thing about it. I know he did. And he was hostile, and he was really angry with us because we'd made him come in from playing Capture the Flag, and we were going to have to do Vespers and stuff, so about 4 to 8 they came in, they were supposed to take their showers and stuff. Well, they were just so angry, and it was obviously they were tired, so that we decided there's no use in playing the Vespers, really. And so I said something about, well, let's read. And all of a sudden, his attitude changed, and he became very contrite, sort of, and said something about, you know, will you read this book to me, or to us? And I sat down, and we started to talk about what they'd done in Narnia, and they both shared this, and the change in attitude was absolutely phenomenal. And we have found that before, when they've just been really hyped up and everything during the day, and you say, well, let's read, and it may take a few minutes to get into it, but incredible, the difference. And they went to bed very calm and content.
We send our kids to bed about a half hour before we want them to go to sleep, and they have an optional reading time. And then after that, we'll ask them what they're reading, what is it about. they're old enough now where they don't want to have that, they don't want to be read to, but they still appreciate reading. Well, you can still participate with them by discussing the book and giving them the time to unwind before you really want them to go to sleep or something.
Yeah, I think, you know, reading what your children read, especially as they grow older, is very important. Reading some of the things, sampling of what they read. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I was just thinking, I'm real intrigued by your question because it's been in my mind very, very often the past couple of years. I thinking of some of the Asian communities, thinking of the Jewish. As a kid, I used to wish I was Jewish because, you know, they had such a sense of identity. And same with, you know, the Chinese. And I would like so much for that to be in my family. You know, I want my kids to have these things that they see as our family is. But I see it as I don't mean to sound depressing, but I see it as just a constant, daily, moment-by-moment battle. You know, and I'm saying that with a lot of sincerity because I...
You mean in terms of striving to make the
to
family...
To get that tradition or that deep sense of family. I mean, not they know that their name is Davis and that they're Lutheran and all that. But, you know, that deep sense that of the family that maybe is taken to extreme in a, you know, typical Chinese family or a Jewish mother. You know, I don't want that, but I want almost that. And it's, you know, at least once your kids get beyond 10 or 11, boy, it's...
I think part of that is affected by the fact that our society is so mobile. I know, you know, I grew up in a very small family in one county in South Carolina, which has driven Johnny to distraction on occasion. But we had lots of very strong family traditions. And one of those was that we ate a number of meals together over holidays, and we always sang together. My grandmother had a piano, and she had a stack of Cokesbury hymnals. And, I mean, there would be 40 of us, and we would sing for an hour and a half. I know more hymns, awful ones, than you can imagine. But that came to be a very meaningful time for me and very much of my, you know, my family life. And, you know, when you live away from your grandparents and that extended family is not there, and those of you who are parish families, who are preacher families, don't always have that option, I'm sure. And we have lived away from our parents for quite a bit of our married life.
I think the strongest tradition in our family came related to Christmas. And this is sort of related, I think, a little bit to what Mary was saying here. Mm-hmm. Because some way we got, both my parents were Danish immigrants. And we took up almost the entire Danish Christmas Eve and Christmas Day and the whole celebration, which is a very family-oriented Christmas celebration. It includes, you have to sing songs, you have to...
Eat a lot.
You have to eat a lot. You read the Bible story and so on. And it is all... And now we go to our children's home and they... Well, we got to sing some songs. Dad's going to read the Christmas story. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing is, our sons-in-laws and daughters-in-laws just think it's great. They say, well, we didn't used to do much. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't have to be that, but I really think it's tremendously important to establish family traditions.
Mm-hmm. I think it's nice that you go to your children's homes too, though, because what happened in my family was that my Christmas was always at my grandparents'. And I never established a very strong sense of Christmas at my parents' home. And my grandparents lived a very long time. And I think you're willing to become a part of their tradition, but in their homes. And I think that's really nice.
Well, we once told them, if you don't come home, we're going to come see you.
You're going to give them a choice. Let me do this to give a little bit of closure and to sort of address what you were asking. What the other item that I had on my notes here was what I called essential learnings for your children in terms of working toward these things. And what I guess I'll do because of time is just throw out the list to you. They're about six or seven, I guess. And then if you have certain ones that you plug into, we'll have 5 or 10 minutes maybe to talk about those. But one very important thing is to teach your child that he or she is unique. And that has a lot to do with self-esteem that we talked about earlier in the week, but that they are special and that they have unique qualities that are their own, and for them to be proud of their uniqueness. So that would be one. Another one is to teach your child that he or she has power and to help him develop that power. And you can break that down into lots of kinds of power, and I had never thought about this before, but we have, and these are 6 different kinds of power, we have body power in terms of our physical strength, and that's one that we put on there. We have intellectual power, and when I mentioned developing potential, I was thinking of that, using whatever intellectual capability you have. We have emotional power to feel our emotions, to express them, and to channel them constructively, or we hope that our children can channel them constructively. We have material power in terms of how we use the environment, and certainly Holden is a wonderful place to refocus our thinking about material power. We have social power in the way that we connect with other people, and Holden again is a place to help develop that. I've especially appreciated that for my 12-year-old who needs some work in that area. And we have spiritual power in terms of our reverence for life. So when we think about developing power in our children, we need to think about all of those areas of life. A third one would be that we need to help our child appreciate his or her sexuality as much by modeling how we relate to one another as husband and wife as any other way. And that, you know, we could go on and on with that about how important the quality of the marriage relationship is to our children coming out this way, in a sense. We need to teach our child to love and enjoy other people. And again, a lot of that is done by modeling. You know, how do we relate to other people? This idea about setting up a family night, which is a family night where the family has fun together, or at least tries. It doesn't always work, I'm sure. But at least you make the effort to enjoy each other's people and to schedule time for that. And we're finding that harder and harder as our children get older, especially having a teenager who can go on his own power now. So do it while your children are young, I guess is what I'd like to say. We need to teach our children that death is a part of life. And there's a nice section about in the book, in Satir's book, about exposing children to or sharing with them the death of members of the family and the consequences of not allowing them to be a part of that, particularly in the death of a parent, but also grandparents. Teaching your child responsibility, which is one of the things that we put up here, and that's a whole subject in itself, is how you do that. And then the last one that I thought was very nice that Satir mentioned was helping your child reach for his or her dreams. And suggestions for getting at that would be to share your own dreams with your children, so that they know that you have something you're moving toward, whether it be something material or something spiritual or something in terms of aesthetics that you haven't developed, and that you pursue your own dreams. You can almost get this martyr complex in terms of, you know, I'm going to give up my goals because of my children, and your children get that message after a while if you do it. You're right, go. But then to assist and support your child in their own pursuit of their dreams. We have one child who's particularly interested in astronomy. I guess a way that we have tried to get at that is that we did give him a telescope for Christmas last year, and that we have taken him to planetariums and taken him to the library and tried to nurture that interest that he has in astronomy. So that's a list. Did something strike you about that, or ideas that you would like to share? I don't like to end with giving a list, but
Now, the thing about the last one, about having, keeping your own hobbies or having hobbies. I'm a pastor, and one of the bishops came around before we graduated and said, have a hobby, have an expensive hobby that will cause you to keep it. And he also said something like, you know, your kids won't understand your job, but maybe they can say, well, my dad builds radio airplanes, or my dad does this. I think especially if, you know, either of you have a job that is very untranslatable back to the home, to have a hobby that defines you in the mind of your child is a very meaningful thing.
That was interesting advice to get from a bishop. Yes.
I look back, and my mother made it very clear that she gave up her life when she had her two children. And I think for a long time I reacted by structuring my life so that children weren't going to be part of it. And I did that. That can be a real powerful message to, you know, maybe go all the way the other way in the sound.
That's very helpful.
Yeah, I think I found it.
Okay. Thank you very much for coming.